Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history.
It's the Christmas season and everyone is rushing around preparing for Christmas, but the reality is that this is actually a very old holiday. The French have got a saying that goes along the lines of, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And Christmas is a good example of that. It's not a perfect example, but you'll see how close it is. And this also is a lesson in how whites change but don't change, and how certain things that whites value are always kept, no matter what. Christians think that Christmas is only about Jesus and the birth of Jesus, but in actual fact, there was a holiday that existed for thousands of years before Christmas, and it took place more or less in the same time frame. There's nothing in the Bible that says that Jesus was born on the 25th of December, but the 25th of December is a very interesting date. In order to understand our ancestors, you need to understand how people thought thousands of years ago. And how did they view the world, and what was their concept of God? So let me explain something to you that most people don't know. And it is that the concept of God, as we have it now in a religion like Christianity, is not the same as the concept of God in ancient times. One thing you will know is that in ancient times people used to talk about multiple gods, but I want to tell you about the main god that existed in the past. If you look on the screen in front of you, you're going to see a bunch of symbols, and they are swastikas from all over different parts of the world. You'll see that there are swastikas from India, swastikas that existed in Russia. There were swastikas even in Peru, in South America. There were swastikas among the Red Indians, the Navajo. There were swastikas in even among the Hittites. The Hittites are ancient whites who lived in the Middle East. There are swastikas that were in Iran, etc. So swastikas existed all over the world, and even non-whites had them, like the Aztecs and so forth. But all these swastikas are really symbols of something real. They are actually symbols of the sun. And in ancient times, the sun was worshipped by whites. We are originally sun worshippers. Jews are moon worshippers, but whites, all European people, were sun worshippers. Some of you will remember that I used to talk about my Boer Nazi pal, Fani Kruger, who lived in Pretoria, and he was a university lecturer in scientific method. Fani told me that in ancient times, that the concept of God was the sun, that people in ancient times could see the sun rising and the sun setting, and they realized that the sun is necessary for life, and the sun is the prime thing that people worship. Fani said to me that God was something that the people could see. When the sun rose in the morning, they were looking at God. That is the God that they worshipped. And they knew that the sun is keeping them alive and that it gives them heat and life. And when the sun goes down, it becomes dark and cold. And this is where the recognition of the seasons also comes from. They started watching the movement of the sun. They began to know about the solstices and how the sun is moving from north to south and south to north, and how this creates the seasons as we know them. This interest in the sky also led to astronomy and astrology, but even serious astronomy was taking place because ancient people began to notice the stars in the sky, the moon in the sky, and they began to observe these things and how they move. And you'd be surprised at how well they measured these things. A symbol like the swastika is nothing more than a stylized version of the sun with the sun's rays. That's all that it is. It's got nothing to do with, oh, this is so evil, it's so decrepit, it's none of the above. The swastika is not got any other meaning. It is the sun. It's a symbol for the sun. And we are a sun-worshipping people. In fact, even the Christians don't realize that a lot of their Christianity has actually taken in some of that original thinking. I'm going to suggest an exercise for Christians. Take a look at this image in front of you. This is an image of Jesus with a halo around his head. And Christians regard that as an example of Jesus's spirituality and goodness. But if you look at this image and other images, you should actually ask yourself whether you're not looking at Jesus as the sun. Now, you might say that this is just an artist and this is not in the Bible. So this was just something an artist drew, but it isn't like this in the Bible. But if you look inside the Bible, there are various numbers that come up in the Bible. And those numbers are interesting. There are 12 disciples. And you should ask yourself, why are there 12 disciples? Because there are certain things that might be things that are brought in from other sources. Returning to the holidays of the pre-Christian whites. For the pre-Christian whites who lived in Europe, especially in the more northern climes, where the summers are short and the winters are very nasty. For those whites, they had a holiday in what is now December, and that holiday was basically a holiday to celebrate that the winter solstice has arrived. In other words, the longest night has now arrived, and from here onwards, the nights are going to be shorter and the days are going to be longer. Spring is coming. So in the middle of winter, whites would have this holiday and celebration that they've gone over this mid-winter mark and that summer is coming and they can't wait for it. And that is really the holiday that we know as Yule. This holiday was known as Yule in the northern regions of Europe, but it had other names in other states and civilizations, whether it was the Greeks or the Romans, but at the end of the day, it was the same thing, that in the middle of winter, that whites have a great celebration, and that celebration is really that the worst of winter is over and that summer is coming. Scientifically, the middle of winter is the 21st or the 22nd of December. But these holidays that fall on various dates, these holidays start from about 23rd, 24th of December, and they occur at various times depending on which whites are celebrating it. But it starts any time from the 23rd, 24th of December, and sometimes in other regions it can occur in January. But it starts from that time onwards. So it's basically a celebration that the worst of winter is over. And For the Christians, the 25th of December is therefore the day of, quotes, Jesus' birth. I think in certain countries like Denmark, they celebrate Yule on the 24th of December. Now, the ancient Greeks had a similar holiday, and it was called Chronia, and it was their liveliest festival of the year. The Romans had a holiday called Saturnalia, which was basically the Roman version of Chronia, but Saturnalia occurred on December the 17th, and the Romans celebrated for not just one day, but for about a week. So you could say it went from December the 17th to December the 24th. So you should be able to see that these dates are very much falling in the same time period. What I'm about to show you is a little video about Yule and the celebrations that took place among the Norse in the northern part of Europe, the Vikings and the other whites in the far north. And there you will see quite a few aspects of what we know as Christmas that were already practiced back then. There are lots of these things that we now associate with Christmas, like the Christmas tree and the giving of presents and Santa Claus. And those things actually come from pagan times. And for whites, Christmas was a fun celebration. It was a real fun celebration everywhere. And nobody celebrated it more enthusiastically, and this may surprise you, than the Romans. But all of these different things, whether it's from Northern Europe or Southern Europe, it's basically the same thing. And you'll see aspects of the one merging into the other. And the other thing to keep in mind is that it was the Romans who basically made Christianity the official religion of Europe. And when that happened, there were lots of pagans who didn't like some of the Christian ideas. So what then happened was there was a merger of some pagan things were carried over quietly into Christianity so that the pagans would feel more comfortable with this new religion. But there were others who rejected it for hundreds of years, and certain aspects of Yule were continued until recent centuries. So characters like Santa Claus, which has got no relationship to the Bible, Santa Claus is basically a modern version, probably, of Old Man Winter. And of course, Odin, the god Odin, was an important feature in the original Yule celebrations. And concepts like Christmas trees and giving presents, again, that's not a Christian thing. There's nothing in the Bible that has that aspect to it. But those kinds of things are things that whites were doing at the time of these celebrations. The giving of presents, families getting together, all of that is pagan stuff. There are Christians who think that paganism was evil and pagans had no values, but that is all total nonsense. When we return to the Romans, I'll show you more about the values that the Romans had. But all white societies had laws and had certain aspects of behavior that were literally identical. The notion that whites in pre-Christian times were wild and lawless and that kind of thing, that's complete nonsense. I will show you things from the writings of ancient authors where they talk about various things, and then you'll see that whites back then were no different to whites now. In fact, things like monogamy actually come from the Germans. And if you go and you look at how marriage worked among whites in ancient times, it's actually very interesting. There was always such a type of thing, a formal link between men and women. And if you look at all our behavior, you'll see that the behavior of the pagans had similar values to modern whites. They didn't like theft. They didn't like murder. They had the same kinds of laws that we have now. In fact, the Romans have kind of helped to mess things up by referring to the non-Romans as barbarians. And the term barbarian has come to have connotations that are not really correct. But the Romans looked down on other whites, and so they regarded them as barbarians. They even laughed at some of the things that they did because they felt superior to them. And in certain respects, they were superior. There were times when the Romans were awesome. But you cannot take the term barbarian in Europe 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago and equate it with barbarian in Africa. You cannot do that. When we look into some of the behavior of the Romans and their interactions with other whites who lived to the north of them, then you'll realize, you'll be stunned at how different Europe was thousands of years ago compared to Africa today. Modern black African barbarism is completely different to any kind of quotes barbarism that you believe whites engaged in the past. And whites had some very, very different as well as sophisticated concepts. There are very interesting things that different tribes believed and different laws and things that they applied in their societies. You may be surprised, but the ancient German tribesmen may well be the original creators of socialism. They were practicing socialism before Christianity even existed. You'd be amazed at some of the thinking of ancient whites in the past. We will be touching on the Romans and other whites that they were fighting against shortly. And then you're going to start seeing some interesting things. You will begin to realize how clever and functional whites were more than 2,000 years ago. The notion that whites were stupid and idiotic 2,000 years ago is complete nonsense. You cannot equate it with anything that you associate with the Middle East or Africa in modern times. There's no comparison. Whites were very functional in the past. Very. And I'm talking all whites. Doesn't matter whether they were Gauls or Germans or Britons or Celts or whatever. They were very functional in a way that will stun you. So here's a short video where you can get an idea of Yule and the way that the Norse used to celebrate the winter solstice. But keep in mind that the Romans merged pagans with this new religion called Christianity. And in so doing, there are things from paganism that actually was quietly put into Christianity because the pagans weren't going to just become Christians if some of their concepts didn't make them feel comfortable. But I just want to urge whites, white Christians, to be careful of some of the anti-pagan Christian propaganda from the past, because there is Christian propaganda that demonizes the pagans, but it's actually not true and there's no evidence for it. You'll actually find that those people were actually clever people and good people, and they were civilized like all whites are. All white societies, regardless of where they are, operate on very similar, if not virtually identical, concepts, regardless of religion. Their actual values in terms of how they interact with each other and treat each other is literally identical. So here's the video.
Many of our modern Christmas traditions stem from a similar holiday celebrated by the ancient Norse. Known as Yule, it was a midwinter festival associated with the rebirth of the sun. Giant wreaths would be set on fire and rolled down a hill to request the return of the sun. For the next 12 days, Vikings and their families would party, drink, and feast. Animals were sacrificed, their meat given to the gods, and some even offered a charity to the poor. There were a variety of other traditions. Men would dress up in goatskins and sing songs about Odin. Some would even dress up as Old Man Winter and be welcomed into neighboring houses. The Yule log wasn't a cake, but a large piece of oak, into which the Vikings and their families would carve runes asking for a boon or protection from the gods, not too dissimilar from a New Year's resolution.
Velkommen alle sammen. How to celebrate Vintersolveif and the proper Old Norse pagan tradition. This is not Yule, okay, as it is commonly referred to in the pagan communities. Yule was originally the first full moon after the winter solstice and three full moons after Veternatr, which was the start of the winter and new year. So Yule is actually the midwinter festival as it would have been practiced in pagan times, and it would have been a full moon in January. In the Viking Age, it was moved by the Christian king Håkon the Good, and he moved Yule back from the full moon following the solstice to the birthday of Jesus in order to try and get the pagans to become more Christian. It didn't work out so well. It didn't work out right away. That took probably many hundreds of years, and they did a couple things different in different places. Sometimes as late as a few hundred years ago, we have records in the folk tradition that the normal Yule Christmas type celebrations were actually being practiced on the solstice, but usually it would be on the 24th or 25th. But originally it would have been the full moon after the new moon after the solstice. See my video I did on that. Contrary to popular belief, we actually have no records that the winter solstice was celebrated at all in the Norse world. Of course they did, you guys. Definitely, of course they did. Focus on the cycles of the sun is absolute key to every single pagan culture in the world, especially in the north of Europe. Ancient humans, remember, who were following animism, and they thought that everything, including the sun, was a living, animate being with a spirit that could also die. The sun was fading, and we're getting to the shortest night of the year right now. If you were far enough north, the sun did die, actually. You wouldn't see the sun for about a month in the middle of winter if you were from the furthest north parts of Norway. So the sun, if it didn't return and come back to life, guess what happens? We are all dead. Nothing is growing, it would be dark forever, and no human would basically be able to survive another year. So, of course, humans had traditions at this time, celebrating the winter solstice. I'm going over a few of the ones we have records of and why they did it, but just keep in mind that basically everything was done to bring back the sun and let the sun continue along its cycle. So the first one comes in the oldest sources, actually, that we have about the Scandinavian people from anywhere, and that's from ancient Greek cartographer Pytheas from about 300 BC. And he traveled to Thule, which it was called, or which he called it, and we're pretty sure that that was Møre og Romsdal, or even as far north as Trondheim, Norway area. And he spoke about the people there, and how the summer solstice, there was no night, and at the winter solstice, there was no day. And at the solstice, they would light their bonfires on top of the hills and mountains as part of their traditions. So this source is a bit difficult, because it's not a source that anybody in modern times has seen still existing. The original writing written by this Greek cartographer isn't still surviving, so we have to rely on other scholars that used his work as a source, and those come from about 800 to 900 years later, and you know, the 300s, 400s, 500s, 600s, such as Pliny the Elder, Procopius, Virgil, who have some of them who didn't actually even believe the reliability of his stories. But we can say that we have record of this exact same tradition in Scandinavia, lighting bonfires on the hills at both solstices, not just the winter, all the way from hundreds of years ago up until today. So we know this has happened as far as we have records in the folk tradition in Scandinavia, and even earlier, the Primstav, some of the earliest Primstav calendars from the 1200s, is marked on the winter solstice. It's marked by a light or a fire. So this is a tradition, lighting at the bonfires on the hills and mountains, that's pretty much been the same over at least 2,000 years. So the notion that just because we have things recorded for the first time, maybe a few hundred years ago, recently in history, that people assume that that makes it not an old pagan thing is all a load of shit, okay? These rituals around the solar cycles is not a Christian thing. That's nothing that the Christians ever did or even encouraged to do or even would have allowed people to do. This idea is this simple animist sympathetic magic that I always speak about. When it's dark in the middle of the winter, the longest night, we light the bonfires in the east in hopes that the sun will also rise over the hills in the east. That is just one example of this kind of animist sun ritual done all over the world, and we know was done long before Christian times in Scandinavia. There are lots more traditions like this. We just maybe only have records of them going back a few hundred years, but like the ancient Greece recording of this tradition, these other rituals could absolutely, in my opinion, be that old, just as old, if not over. So we'll speak about another one here, Lussekatter, a popular Scandinavian baked dessert that we eat at this time of year. It's in the shape of a swastika, which originally has a strong connection to the sun and its cycles. This is actually more of a St. Lucia's Day recipe. It's supposed to be made on the 13th of December. It's called Lussekatter in Sweden, but in Norway, they're still called Langnattskake, so Long Night's Cake, referring to the longest night of the year, which is the eve of the solstice. I don't even have to tell you guys, you already know the original pagan holiday that the church came around and forbid, and they wanted to change the date of it so people would celebrate it on the death of one of their saints, but it was an original pagan holiday. We can also include most other circular things that are hung up or used in this Christmas time tradition like that. Kringle, julekranse, wreaths, walking in circles around a Christmas tree. All things still used today in the Scandinavian tradition. It's survived all the way up until today, most of these. And not just that, usually any other clockwise motions are part of this tradition too, because that's the direction that the sun moves in. Again, the idea is to do these things, to cook these lussekatter, to have these wreaths, to walk around the Christmas tree. It's supposed to be influencing the sun to travel along that same cycle going clockwise, so in hopes that this may influence the sun to keep returning and go a part of its regular cycle. Another one, very cool. After the solstice, we can now cut our hair and beards. As I mentioned on the video a couple months back about Veternatter, you don't cut your hair from the start of winter until the solstice has already passed. The idea is that if we let our hair grow and we don't cut it, then all the crops and plants and life in the surrounding farm, villages and area will also be influenced to grow and germinate in this dark, cold time. It's just that idea that one action affects everything else in a similar way going on in the whole village or even the whole universe, as I've spoke about with those sun rituals. And these records, guys, by the way, they come from the Scandinavian folk tradition. All kinds of records of these traditions come from really scattered sources and from remote villages, and they're very difficult to find. But if you want to read more, you can check out Våre Traditioner by Vegard Solheim. And he has that one available in English now. There's also a couple others, Scandinavian Folk Belief and Legends. I think even Trolldom has a few records of these types of things and traditions too. But that's about all you're going to find on these written in English. But these are all like rituals that I'm speaking of, attested in some small rural villages, going back 400 or 500 years. But of course, we can say they might be a lot older than that. It's just in those small rural villages that might be the only place they still survived. We can also speak about decorating the pine and fir trees, although this is more of a Sami tradition, actually, that we have records of. And the Sami, their pagan religion, survived in Scandinavia much longer, all the way up until the 1800s. So they did some winter solstice traditions like animal sacrifices, and they hung the offerings up in the trees. They also hung up the Amanita muscaria mushrooms in the trees. They hung up feathers, fur, and other especially red-colored items like berries or mistletoe. Red objects symbolize the blood and the life force, and the idea there is that they give the life force to these evergreen trees in hopes that they will continue to survive the winter and the new year to come, because the evergreen trees are basically the only things, some of the only things that don't die off in winter. So this tradition was done more by the Sami and the Finns that we have records of, but it was very illegal to do these things for Norwegians, up until a certain point. So what they did in the basically Germanic cultural area of Scandinavia, instead of doing those types of decorations, they would sprinkle the evergreen trees with wine or glögg, which represents also the blood and the life force. The wine represents blood and life force in pretty much every culture and spiritual belief around the world. So they definitely did that in Scandinavia too, we have records of. People in both the Sami and the Germanic cultural areas of Scandinavia also decorated themselves with red, especially the women. They would wear bright white dresses and color it with certain red colorings, certain parts of the dress, or they would wear red belts or wear red hats or things like that, again representing the life force. And we can finally maybe speak about burial sites. It has been tradition in Scandinavia to go see your family members where they have been buried. You go to their graves, especially on the solstice or a little bit before, and you leave flowers or decorations, even if this is a Christian churchyard. We have burials all over Europe going back at least 5,000 years, where the actual entrances to these burial chambers line up exactly with the sunlight on the winter solstice, shining up the entrance to the burial chamber or dolmen or whatever. And most it happens most in the Celtic areas of Britain, but we find a good amount of them in Scandinavia and other parts of Europe too. And the idea and the theory behind this is, okay, these are 5,000 years old, we don't have any written sources from then, but the idea is that they were built this way so that the sunlight could meet them and in this entrance on the winter solstice, and then the ancestral spirits would be woken up and they could be reborn, and basically the same as the sun cycle comes back, life comes around and gets reincarnated at this longest night. It also lines up with a lot of these fertility rituals and when they would practice a lot of their sacred marriages or a May Queen type of thing like that in the spring. And we're talking like March, April, May. So then the baby would in turn be born from now in the next month or two, really. So it lines up well. So the ancestral spirit would go into the mother, or the pregnant mother, and take residence in the child that was about to be born. See the video I did on Easter, and I speak a bit more about that. But that's all for this video. Those are just some of the things that we know, or we can at least be fairly sure of, that they were doing in pagan times, and things that are very easy for us to do today. Like I said, it all revolves around the cycles of the sun and doing things to make sure the sun stays along its cycle and comes back to life, and in turn gives us and our dead ancestral spirits life as well. So lots more traditions actually, though, that we can speculate on. And the origin and the meaning of, you can check out the podcast I did about a year ago with Bjorn from the Hamingja Foundation. That link will be below, along with all the sources as usual. So hope you all had a great solstice, and that's all for today. Vi ses nästa gång.
Now let's turn our attention to the Roman Christmas, which is known as Saturnalia. And in this video, you'll see the fun side of the Romans and what they did. And this video will also show you a few of the things that changed from Saturnalia to Christmas, because the Romans were the ones who made Christianity our official religion.
Winter celebrations are popular across the world, with Christmas dominating much of the Western tradition. It's a winning recipe of things we love. Friends, family, gift-giving, singing, feasting, partying, and more. The Romans too celebrated Christmas as far back as the 4th century AD. However, before that, they had their own winter holiday, which honestly blows the stockings off our own tradition. It was a week-long Mardi Gras-style street festival, fueled by endless drinking, where slaves became masters and fools were crowned king. You had all your classic holiday-style caroling and gift-giving, though far, far naughtier, with a healthy dose of ancient blackjack and hookers sprinkled on top. This was the festival of Saturnalia, Rome's awesome pagan Christmas. Like many in the ancient world, the Roman year was filled with festivals. These celebrated all kinds of important events, but were aimed mostly at making sure the gods were kept happy. After all, there was nothing more important for the well-being of the individual and the state. Such holidays were known as dies feriales. There were many of these every month, each with their own specific traditions. Generally speaking, the more important festivals coincided with major events like the change of seasons or the new year, with the relevant god or gods taking center stage. A short list of some of those festivals includes the Lupercalia in February, the Liberalia in March, the Bonadia and the Lemuria in May, the Ludi Apollinaris in July, the Herculean Victus in August, and the Saturnalia in December. While all of these certainly merit their own episode, today we'll be focusing on Rome's end-of-year festival that would later transform into our Christmas. As with most other Roman religious customs, Saturnalia traces its origins back to the Greeks. It is this Hellenistic civilization which influenced Roman mythology early in its development, and would continue to do so over the centuries. The Roman god Saturn, for example, is roughly synonymous with the Greek god Cronus, both of whom are associated with rebirth, harvest, and heralding a new golden age. In Rome, the holiday of Saturnalia started out humbly as an agricultural festival set around the winter solstice in December, when the people would collect their last harvest of the year. As they concluded this work, they would mark the occasion by honoring Saturn. This would be done at the temple of the harvest god at the foot of the Capitoline Hill. Here, Rome's priests would gather at the head of the population with the other upper classes wearing their best togas and the plebeians wearing their finest tunics. A parade of bulls, the largest of the year, would then be brought in and sacrificed. The event was carried out under the watchful eye of Saturn himself. The way this worked is the priests would actually bring with them a statue of the god bound in wool. As the ceremonies began, they would ritualistically unwrap the statue and place it on a couch. Symbolically, this represented the idea of rebirth, where Saturn would appear like a newborn child springing from the womb in the 10th month. Once upon his couch, the god would then be able to partake in the feasts which followed. For the remainder of the day, all forms of work and public business would be suspended. Over time, as Rome grew, the holiday would continue to evolve. The official ceremony we have just described apparently underwent a series of reforms around the 3rd century BC, when Greek practices were imported upon consultation with the Sibylline books. Additionally, the festival would now be pinned to December 17th, rather than arbitrarily following the final harvest. Because of the holiday's popularity, it was also incrementally expanded over time, from one feast day up to a total of seven. Let's now take a closer look at the full glory of this pagan Christmas. The days leading up to Saturnalia would have Rome abuzz. As a major public holiday, it was the duty of the aediles to oversee the official preparations. With their reputation on the line, they would have been hard at work planning on how to make this year's celebrations as memorable as possible. Part of this involved employing hundreds of laborers to transform Rome for the occasion by cleaning the streets, setting up decorations, and erecting temporary structures. This would be necessary to accommodate the huge swell in the city's population caused by celebrants flocking in from the countryside. After all, Rome was still a highly rural society, with many small towns and farms dominating the land. Saturnalia, as a harvest festival, was a particularly strong magnet for farmers who were keen to give thanks to Saturn, as well as to be able to reunite with old friends and acquaintances in the big city. Thus, Rome's homes, inns, and taverns filled with growing excitement as families looked forward to the festivities. With the day slowly ticking away, people were sure to be rushing around to make final preparations and close out business before the holidays. Finally, the day would come. It was December 17th. Starting in the early hours of the morning, people across Rome would awake and begin to stream into the Forum, eager to secure the best spots and celebrate the time-honored tribute to Saturn. Once settled, they waited with bated breath. Soon, their patience would be rewarded by a low rumble that would begin to grow and grow until, in the distance, its source was revealed. A grand parade was making its way through the streets of Rome. At its head were the priests and Senate, and behind them, a seemingly endless line of bulls. This procession made its way past the throngs of onlookers until eventually coming to a stop before the Temple of Saturn. Here, the animals would then be sacrificed and a great feast prepared with a reclining statue of Saturn as its honorary guest. Surely the god would be most pleased by this dazzling display of piety. Rome's good fortune for the following year had been secured. Thus ended the official component of Saturnalia. All public business was stopped on this day and would remain closed for the duration of the festival. No law courts were conducted, all schools were closed, and even the mechanisms to declare war were shut down. This was a time for celebration, and the Romans were particularly good at that. The following free-flowing festivities were guided only by customs. But while unregulated, they did share the common theme of a world turned upside down where traditional roles and social norms were inverted. It seems that this may have gotten its origin as a nod to the idea of a return to Saturn's golden age, which had existed before rank and order, before slavery and property. Now was a time to make this Edenic existence a reality. The first sign of change were the holiday clothes. During the festival, people traded their bland togas for brightly colored garments, and everyone, from emperor to slave, wore the felt pileus cap, which traditionally signified one's status as a free man. The second sign of change was the new social order. Each family would select a princeps, or leader of Saturnalia, who was typically of lower status. This might be a child or servant. Slaves were now treated as equals, and might even be elevated to the point that their masters served them. Reportedly, slaves were exempt from punishment, and even allowed to insult their masters, within bounds of reason. This all came together at the grand public feast on the first day of Saturnalia, following the religious ceremony at the Temple of Saturn. The aediles for the year would actually foot the bill and plan out the banquet, which meant that its appearance depended on who was responsible, and how much money they had. Most of the time, tables would be set up in the Forum, the only open space large enough to hold such a large population. The aediles would coordinate with the hundreds of local bakeries and other food providers who worked overtime to build up a massive stockpile for the occasion. The meals were as extravagant as possible and became truly incredible with the rise of the cosmopolitan empire. Arriving at the feast, one would witness a truly impressive display. From the bakers came the best breads, tarts, spice cakes, pastries, and little Gaiuses, while from the merchants and farmers came produce of every description. Plums, pears, apples, nuts, dates, and more. They would be incorporated into dishes, made into candied fruit, and eaten whole. In addition were all kinds of meats, and wines from every corner of the empire were set out to give the illusion of a truly unlimited river of drink. Even rare delicacies were served up to all, things that the upper classes ate, but the poor couldn't afford, like stuffed dormice, sow wombs, as well as varieties of exotic fish and birds, including lampreys, flamingos, and peacocks. this fantastical banquet of dreams was gorged upon by all of Rome. For hours, everyone ate and drank to their heart's content. When the meal was finally winding down, the shouts of Yo Saturnalia would break out. They heralded that the greatest party of the year had only just begun. For 7 days, people partied in a carnival-like atmosphere akin to a New Orleans Mardi Gras. Everyone was encouraged to join in on the fun, and sleep was in short supply. However, there were of course your typical Christmas grinches. The philosopher Seneca apparently tried to convince a friend to replace the wild revelry with a quiet dinner, and Pliny the Younger actually had a soundproof suite built so that he could get work done throughout the week while his entire household partied. But peace and quiet were truly hard to come by. Here is a revealing quote from Libanius. Night falls, but no one sleeps. The common people engage in songs, wild dancing, and mocking jest. They do this even in the commercial district, barging in, pounding on doors, shouting and mocking. Some people are angry with what they hear, but others consider it an occasion for laughter. No one present is so austere that he censures these goings-on. Even he who is too self-controlled to laugh breaks out laughing. Meanwhile, the public spaces teemed with activity. The Forum, for instance, drew huge crowds to see a range of itinerant performers, from jugglers to puppeteers and snake charmers. Otherwise, illegal gambling tables were set up as well and drew many participants. Sponsors might also pay for lavish displays of entertainment. In one instance, we hear of female gladiatrices, dwarfs, buxom Lydian girls, and performers who came in from Syria to Spain. Emperors too got in on the fun and were not to be outdone. One of these was the practice of gift-giving, which took place throughout the week. The poet Martial writes about individual, personalized gifts with small greeting cards to go with them, and even alludes to a secret Santa-style form of gift-giving that was popular. These ancient Roman presents could be anything. Musical instruments, writing tablets, boxes of hobby supplies, beauty products, toothpicks, tableware, exercise equipment, weapons, or even a well-bred pig. Children generally got dolls, while close friends were given special wax candles that were lit to signal the advent of a golden age coming in the new year. Augustus himself loved the holiday and gave lavish and gag gifts in equal measure. Quote, on the Saturnalia, and at any other time when he took it into his head, he would sometimes give gifts of clothing or gold and silver, sometimes all kinds of coins including old pieces of the king's and foreign money, sometimes nothing, but haircloth, sponges, pokers, and tongs, and other such things under misleading names of double meaning. Sometimes the sheer volume of presents required for the holidays lowered their average quality. As Marshall writes, quote,
let everyone give his guest an appropriate gift. But they're all worthless garbage, you might say. Well, no one says they're not. No one would deny anything so obvious.
Another tradition with modern echoes was the practice of the kings of Saturnalia, who were crowned by lot. During their reign, they had to be obeyed, with the sole requirement that their edicts be dumb commands. For example, telling everyone in the street to stop what they were doing and dance, to give the flute girls piggyback rides around the block, or to dunk an innocent bystander in a nearby fountain. However, things could go too far if the liberties of the holiday crossed the line into reality. For example, we are told that when Julius Caesar was celebrating Saturnalia after having won his civil war, his lieutenant Mark Antony made a big show of offering the crown of Saturnalia to Caesar. This was met by the fury of a booing crowd. The role was supposed to be a joke, making a mockery of the powerful. To give the joke crowned to an actual dictator of Rome was not fun, and struck a little too close to home. Clearly, there were still some lines that should not be crossed. At long last, the festival of Saturnalia came to an end. The kings were symbolically dethroned to mark the occasion, and everyone had their last hurrah with shouts of Yo Saturnalia. Perhaps their throbbing heads would look forward to the days of calm which followed, but it wouldn't be long before they began to dream of next year's festivities. As one might imagine, the tremendous popularity of Saturnalia ensured that it lived on for centuries. This trend was further propelled because, unlike many other Roman festivals, the Saturnalia was not tied to the city of Rome itself, and therefore gained traction across the empire. After all, winter celebrations are a universal tradition which transcend borders, especially when they involve the winning combination of feasting, drinking, and partying. Such was the popularity of Saturnalia that when Christianity rose to dominance in the 4th century AD, the pagan holiday would be co-opted rather than cancelled. It appears that this is one of the reasons Christmas was set just a few days after Saturnalia on the 25th instead of the 17th, and maintained many of the same customs. This hybridized holiday was a far rowdier event in these early days, and while the mass street partying has generally been toned down over the ages, many things are still held as a tradition. For years, the Feast of Fools was an incredibly popular festival until it was banned by the church in the 15th and 16th centuries. Wax candles are still a central part of a traditional Christmas with Advent candles, and freedmen's caps have generally been replaced by Santa hats, or if you live in Britain, paper caps and crowns. And of course, the tradition of giving gifts to family and friends is still running strong.
Let's turn to the Germans, specifically the Nazis and World War II, and Christmas with the Nazis. On the screen in front of you are two images. The one on the top left is a Wehrmacht belt buckle. If you look carefully at the belt buckle, it reads Gott mit uns, and you can see that it's got the Nazi eagle there, which, by the way, is the same thing as the eagle in America, is the same thing as the eagle that comes from Rome. You can see under it the swastika. So, Gott mit uns is God with us. It's the only army in World War II that had any kind of reference to God or religion in that sense. The German army with these Gott mit uns belt buckles. And then the picture on the bottom right is the coat of arms of Prussia. Prussia is the original state from which Germany comes. And you can see there the eagle, etc., the swastika, and you can see above the eagle it says Gott mit uns. So same thing, God with us. So you can see that under the Nazis, the concept of God was something that was used openly. You cannot say that the Nazis did not allow religion or did not have any value or thought of God. On the screen in front of you are two images. The one on the left is Positive Christianity in the Third Reich, and it's written by a professor. It's a book. I will be giving this book away for free on my websites in the coming weeks. And then on the top right, you see a flag from Germany. This is a flag from Nazi Germany, and it's the Positive Christianity flag for the Positive Christianity movement. So you can see the swastika there, and you can see the Christian cross, but you can see that it's on a flag that is definitely based on the Nazi flag. The DC stands for Deutsche Christians, German Christians. Let me just talk a little bit about Christianity and the Nazis. There are people who've tried to portray Hitler as a Christian, and there are some people who claim that he's a Roman Catholic, etc. I personally very much doubt that. I don't think he was an actual Christian. But that doesn't mean that one must go and believe the lies of the Jews. The Jews run around and the Jews try by every means to make you believe that the Nazis were evil scum, who didn't allow people to do their own thing, that the Nazis were hideous, bone-crushing machines who smashed everybody into the ground, etc. That is not true. And that is most especially not true with regard to the Nazis and the Germans that they were ruling. And remember, the Germans elected them. They went through the democratic process. They stood in multiple elections as the political party grew. The Nazis came to power through democratic means in a country where men and women could vote. So men and women voted for Hitler. White men and white women voted for Hitler. This is a democracy, it's a real democracy. In fact, The truth of the matter is that it's probably the most real democracy that has existed since the Roman Empire. Because unlike the British and the Americans and others, where Jews play a big role in controlling the politics and political parties, in Germany, this was a grassroots movement that came from the bottom up, and it was sanctioned by the masses of the Germans. So as far as I can see, this is real democracy. And like I say, possibly one of the most real democracies since the Roman Empire, actually, or since the Roman Republic, rather. And the majority of the Germans were Christians. The Germans were serious Christians in the same way that the Boers are in South Africa, that the Afrikaners are in South Africa. And there are various generals who even openly spoke about being Christians. General von Manstein, for example, in his memoirs, he spoke often about the fact that he was a Christian, the fact that his family were Christians, his son was a Christian, etc. The majority of Germans were Christians, and the Nazis understood that. Most of the Nazi leaders might not have been Christians, but that did not change the fact that they understood their people and they allowed them to believe what they wanted to believe. They might have had differences with the issue of Christianity, which I'm not going to go into here. But the fact is that unlike the Jewish Bolshevik Soviet Union, which was openly atheist and which totally crushed all religion, the Nazis allowed their people the freedom to believe what they wanted to believe. In the days before I really studied the Germans and the Jewish issue, I remember the lie being told, and I believed it, that the Nazis and the communists were almost identical, that Hitler's Germany and Jewish Bolshevik Soviet Union were pretty much the same thing. That is completely and utterly not true. The Germans are totally different. The Germans are very humane to their own people. The Germans work with their people. All the German leaders worked with their people. The Nazis really cared for the common man. The common people loved the Nazis. And the common white workers benefited massively from Nazi rule, from Hitler's rule. Hitler gave common people big opportunities. Hitler was very much against the rich and the control of the rich over business and industries, etc. Hitler even outlawed supermarkets and chain stores. He wanted small businesses to exist and to succeed. If there's any leader who was in favor of small white business, it was Hitler. He helped common people to live and to live well. They cared for their people. They weren't inhumane to their people. They spoke to their people and they gave their people probably the best economic system that white people have ever lived under. I'm not going to go into the topic of what is positive Christianity, but the German leadership showed in many ways that they were willing to allow their people to believe what they wanted to believe. A guy called Alfred Rosenberg, who was a major thinker for the Nazi Party, played a big role in the creation of positive Christianity. Positive Christianity is a type of Christianity that is closer to the original Christianity. But positive Christianity also had a difference in that positive Christianity did not have the kinds of problems that you get with modern Christianity, which is split into lots of different denominations and types. Positive Christianity did not have different denominations. But you still had Germans who were Catholics, Germans who were Protestants, over and above that. Other things that the Germans had was they did have chaplains in their army. The Wehrmacht had chaplains that were in the military and that gave services and various funeral rites, etc., on the battlefield. One of my German friends, who's a deep Christian, even said to me that more Christian churches were built under Nazi rule than there were before. He said that there were actually more Christian churches that were built during the time of the Nazis. He even gave me a figure. I'm not sure if he said that 1,000 churches were built during the time of Hitler's rule. Something like that. So you cannot come and say, and you can never equate Nazi Germany with the Jewish Bolshevik Soviet Union. You can never do that. In the Soviet Union, they killed Christians, they wiped Christians out, they destroyed churches, they smashed things into the ground. That is not at all anything like what happened in Germany. Another lie that Jews happily spread is the notion that communism's so-called socialism and Hitler's socialism is the same thing. That's not true. There is a lot of Jewish and white capitalist propaganda that socialism is evil, socialism is bad, that all socialism is bad and only capitalism is good. That's a bunch of Jewish and business propaganda, and it's not true. You cannot equate what Hitler did with socialism with what the Soviet Union and all communists did with socialism. And when you get blacks who believe in communism, like Julius Malema and others in South Africa, they also use the word socialism, but their meaning of socialism is the Soviet meaning of socialism. They're going to come and they're going to seize all the businesses and the government's going to own everything, etc. But that is not what Hitler did. Hitler did not go and just nationalize things. Hitler worked with big business and small business, and their system was fantastic. In fact, if you look at the way Hitler worked with German businesses when it comes to military contracts and things, for example, it is identical to the way the British and the Americans and everybody else works with businesses that produce weapons. The way in which the British or the Americans will put out a requirement for a weapons system and that kind of thing is exactly the same way that the Germans worked. And they also had multiple companies coming back with designs and plans for various weapons and things. And the process was exactly the same. This was completely different to the Soviet Union, where they nationalized things, the government owned everything, etc. It wasn't like that at all. And the Germans as a people were not this suppressed people who were not allowed to think for themselves. The Wehrmacht, the German army of World War II, is completely misrepresented by the Allies and the Jews. The way that the German army worked and the way that German soldiers were encouraged to work is a separate topic, but it is very different to the notion that the Germans were regimented, mindless automatons who weren't allowed to think for themselves. The German army was actually very flexible. It was actually very awesome. It was probably much more like the Roman army, in fact. But that's a topic I'll return to separately. The personality of the average German. Germans are not the way that these Jewish scum and allied liars portray them as. And I must tell you that Professor Jordan Peterson is a big freaking liar. He's an anti-German hater and a big flipping liar on exactly these topics. He lies through his teeth. with regard to the Germans. He tells so many lies about the Germans. He's a piece of shit. Jordan Peterson is an anti-white piece of shit, and he's a German-hating piece of crap. Virtually everything you've heard about Hitler and World War II and the Nazis, virtually everything is a total lie. Take a look at this photo on the screen. Here you can see a Nazi Christmas party in 1941, and this Christmas party was hosted by Hitler. So you can see all the decorations and the swastika and all that kind of stuff. So the Nazis celebrated Christmas. They were carrying on in the same way that whites have done. This is our winter solstice holiday, and whether you're a Christian or whether you're a pagan, this is basically our biggest holiday, our most critical holiday, and it's the winter solstice celebration. Whether you say that it's for Jesus and Jesus' birth, or whether you say that it is the middle of the winter, either way, this is the big celebration and holiday that whites have always celebrated. And as you should appreciate, whether you're a Viking, whether you're from Denmark or Norway or Sweden, whether you are a Greek or a Roman or a Nazi, hey, this is the same holiday. Everybody has been celebrating it for thousands of years. So what you can see is basically just how we maybe change our politics and change our beliefs, but some things remain the same. As the French said, the more things change, the more they remain the same. And the story of Christmas is a perfect example of that. The following short videos are going to show you some stuff about Hitler at Christmas time. And you'll see Hitler with children, and you'll see Hitler celebrating Christmas himself.
Yeah.
How was that for a Nazi Christmas? And did you see the chaplains among the soldiers? And there was Hitler with little children. The biggest lie that has ever been told is the lie that the Germans were inhumane monsters. Okay? That's total crap. The Nazis were not inhumane monsters. That is just a total freaking lie. Through and through. If anything, their root cause was to assist common people and give common people a chance at life. And common workers in Germany lived the best life that workers have ever lived in Germany, ever, even right up to today. People owned cars and houses and that kind of thing. When they got married, they were given houses and furniture and stuff like that. Things that don't happen anywhere on earth nowadays. Nowadays, young people across the Western world will struggle to ever own property or a house. Let me tell you, socialism, when carried out properly, the way the Germans did it, is very likely the most awesome economic system ever invented. But Jews don't want you to know that. Jews need to lie to you to keep you away from that. Because then you'll realize that the real people ripping you off are the rich. So here's wishing you all a Merry Yule and a Merry Christmas, and I hope you have a happy and good New Year. Let's have a nice little musical interlude. Here's a pop song from 1972. It's sung by a lovely Greek lady known as Nana Mouskouri, and the song is entitled in French Soleil Soleil. And soleil in French means sun. So this is a pop song about the sun. And this was at least from a time when a lot of music was still white and still made sense. And there were things that were done pretty decently. So here's Nana Mouskouri and Soleil Soleil. Oh,
le ciel sera moins gris. Soleil, soleil, soleil,
give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you will. Every fight you